Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
Kerry says the U.S. supports African-led efforts against conflicts. West and Central Africa are lagging in HIV care. I'm Frances Alonzo reporting from Washington. Secretary of State John Kerry says the United States supports African-led efforts to combat the most deadly conflicts of the continent. He said today during a visit to Addis Ababa that too many nations are at risk of descending into broad-based violence.
It is clear that the unspeakable violence in the Central African Republic, the deliberate killing of civilians on both sides in South Sudan, both of those underscore the urgency of the work that we have to do together.
Kerry visited the African Union headquarters in the Ethiopian capital for talks with officials on the CAR, where Muslims continue to flee their homes to escape attacks by Christian militia. Earlier today, he met with the foreign ministers of Ethiopia, Uganda, and Kenya to discuss the challenges of how to get South Sudan's warring sides to halt their months of deadly fighting. Doctors Without Borders says only 20% of people living with HIV in French-speaking West and Central Africa are receiving the antiretroviral drug treatment they need. This is despite enormous progress made in the fight against HIV/AIDS in Southern Africa. Jennifer Lazuda reports.
The medical aid group Doctors Without Borders, MSF, says governments and aid agencies need to do more to help those living with HIV in West and Central Africa. MSF says that despite a relatively low prevalence of HIV in the region, less than 5% of the population, only a fifth of HIV patients who need antiretroviral treatment, ART, receive it. Countless others die before they are diagnosed due to a lack of access to testing. Jennifer Lazuda for VOA News, Dakar.
Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has called for talks between Kiev and pro-Russian separatists in southeastern Ukraine. The prime minister spoke during a visit to Peru. In eastern Ukraine, local authorities said Wednesday that pro-Russian gunmen had seized control of a city council building. Meanwhile, Ukraine's interim president has said his government is helpless to quell the growing pro-Russian separatist movement in two eastern regions and cannot control its own troops. Chinese President Xi Jinping is promising decisive action after a deadly bomb and knife attack at a train station in the western province of Zhejiang. Officials say three people were killed and 79 injured late Wednesday when attackers set off explosives and slashed passengers at the south station in the regional capital Urumqi. Meanwhile, the government is investigating. Thailand says new elections will be held July 20th to try to end months of political deadlock. VOA's Steve Herman reports.
The main opposition Democrat Party says another election is not feasible under present conditions. Party spokesman Chavanon Intara Kamalyasut tells VOA the government needs to agree to implement reforms for the Democrats to participate in polling.
I don't see that we can have the free and fair election. We are afraid that the upcoming election, if it could ever happen on July 20, is going to be the same as what happened February 2nd.
The Democrats boycotted that election, and anti-government protesters blockaded enough polling stations to invalidate the vote. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
Twin blasts have ripped through a passenger train in India just minutes after it pulled into the Chennai's railway station, killing a woman and injuring at least nine people. Authorities say two explosions early today were in two sleep coaches. Police are investigating what they suspect were bombs planted under passenger seats. No one has claimed responsibility for the blasts. It took 17 minutes for authorities to realize that Malaysian Airlines Flight 370 had gone off the radar. That's according to a preliminary report released today by the Malaysian government. The report also says it took hours before an official search and rescue operation was dispatched to locate the still missing passenger jet. Northern Ireland's Sinn Féin party leader Gerry Adams remains in police custody for questioning about the 1972 abduction and murder of a widowed mother of 10. Police arrested the 65-year-old Adams on Wednesday. Adams had acknowledged associations with the IRA, but has repeatedly denied any involvement in the Jean McConville case. She was abducted by the Irish Republican Army from her Belfast home and shot to death. More at voanews.com. I'm Frances Alonzo. VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiyas Wuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
There are very disturbing leading indicators of the kind of ethnic, tribal, targeted, nationalistic killings taking place that raise serious questions. And were they to continue in the way that they've been going, could really present a very serious challenge to the international community with respect to the question of genocide.
That's U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry in Ethiopia's capital saying those responsible for what he calls unspeakable violence in South Sudan must be brought to justice. Details coming up.
Also in the news, the Committee to Protect Journalists has launched a campaign to highlight the cases of journalists imprisoned around the world.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Algeria, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, South Sudan's warring factions resumed face-to-face peace talks today. It's the third such effort this year. The resumption of negotiations coincides with U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry's meeting with regional leaders in Addis Ababa. At the meeting, they agreed on the need for a legitimate force to stabilize South Sudan. Marta van der Werf reports from Addis Ababa.
Pressure is growing on the South Sudan government and the opposition to reach some concrete agreements at this round of talks in Ethiopia. Since the conflict erupted in mid-December, the parties have only agreed on a ceasefire, which has been largely ignored. Siyum Mesfin, chairman of the East African Bloc IGAD mediation team, says an interim political arrangement is one of the items on the agenda.
Which envisages that the parties would negotiate for an interim or a transitional period, and which might lead them into the establishment of a national unity government for the interim period. The time frame for the interim period and the nature of the national unity government, its size, and its tasks during the interim period. This have to be negotiated by the parties.
IGAD says it is not imposing this upon the two negotiating parties, but both sides have accepted to negotiate on this topic. South Sudan Information Minister Michael McQuay says all outstanding issues will be discussed.
The first point in the agenda tomorrow is the strengthening of the cessation of hostilities and the commitment or a dedication to the implementation and operationalization of the cessation of hostilities.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry met with his counterparts from Ethiopia, Uganda and Kenya Thursday in Addis Ababa on ways to facilitate an agreement. All agreed on the need for a legitimate force to be deployed. In addition, the United States has put into place a mechanism to apply travel bans or freeze assets if needed on individuals deemed as perpetuating the violence in South Sudan. IGAD has also recently deployed monitoring and verification teams on the ground in Bor, Malakal and Bentiu. It has been 3 weeks since the last round of talks took place. Siyum Mesfin has made it clear that he wants both parties to produce concrete results.
More killings have taken place in the country after the signing of the cessation of hostilities than before. This is lack of commitment on both parties. The region, the IGAD region and the international community are saying enough is enough to this sort of breaching of agreement.
Fighting in South Sudan erupted after President Salva Kiir accused his former vice president Riek Machar of a coup. The violence has left thousands dead and more than a million displaced. More people will be affected soon as a famine is looming in the country. Most farmers could not plant their fields before the upcoming rain season because of the security situation. Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
Also today, Secretary Kerry is warning of the risk of genocide in South Sudan if 4 months of fighting there is not stopped. VOA State Department correspondent Scott Stearns reports from Ethiopia.
Secretary Kerry says those responsible for what he calls unspeakable violence in South Sudan must be brought to justice to prevent the conflict from deteriorating further.
There are very disturbing leading indicators of the kind of ethnic, tribal, targeted, nationalistic killings taking place that raise serious questions, and were they to continue in the way that they have been going, could really present a very serious challenge to the international community with respect to the question of genocide.
Kerry says he's working with regional leaders to avoid that by moving to put people on the ground who can begin to make a difference, separating people and providing security. He met here in Addis Ababa with foreign ministers from Ethiopia, Kenya, and Uganda, who he says all agree on the need for African troops under a United Nations mandate. He also pushed them to join U.S. moves toward a travel ban and assets freeze on those responsible for the violence, but said Washington is absolutely prepared to move on its own.
We may well move on our own, but each of the foreign ministers today accepted the responsibility for also doing sanctions.
Kerry says some of the violence is the responsibility of individual generals with their own agenda, but the place to start is the place where it started, and that's with South Sudan's President Salva Kiir and his former Vice President Riek Machar. The most serious fighting began in late December, soon after the Kiir government accused Machar of trying to seize power. While a senior State Department official says Washington does not buy into the narrative of a coup attempt, Kerry says there is a clear distinction between the men whose personal anger is fueling this violence.
The current president of South Sudan is the elected constitutional president of a country. And Mr. Machar is a rebel who is trying to unconstitutionally take power by force. And there is a clear distinction. There is no equivalency between the two.
Kerry says Machar needs to think clearly about that, particularly in the wake of allegations that ethnic Nuer rebels killed hundreds of civilians in the town of Bentiu last month. A UN report says the rebels separated individuals of certain nationalities and ethnic groups and escorted them to safety while the others were killed. A rebel spokesman has denied that allegation. Scott Stearns, VOA News, Addis Ababa.
Thank you, Scott. The International Rescue Committee says it's not too late to prevent South Sudan from falling into a prolonged conflict. However, the humanitarian group says it will require a lot of international pressure and greater support for the UN presence. VOA's Joe DiCampoa reports.
IRC Country Director Wendy Teuber says just 2.5 years ago, South Sudan was a place of hope. Action is needed now, she says, to preserve the gains made since South Sudan gained its independence. She calls it an opportunity, despite the many horror stories being reported. That said, Teuber warns conditions of late have deteriorated.
With the increased fighting, further displacement, and the onset of the rainy season, it's sort of a perfect storm, if you will, of complete calamity on the horizon if we don't act now. So it's a very important moment to do as much as we can.
Speaking from the capital, Juba, Teuber says the many years of U.S. support have created a lot of goodwill in South Sudan and give the Obama administration leverage. She's encouraged by the scheduled visit of Secretary of State John Kerry.
We're hoping that he can talk to all sides and encourage them to really push forward on some kind of peace agreement. I mean, we don't want to be naive in thinking that the fighting will stop overnight, but certainly there's things we can ask for. The 30-day period of tranquility, it would be wonderful if parties could at least agree to a ceasefire for the month of May, during which time people would be free to move around, plant, reunite with their families.
Teuber says Kerry could lend some renewed energy to the peace process.
The talks in Ethiopia have not been going very well, but we hope that high-level engagement of someone at John Kerry's level could give a jump start to renewed negotiations and some fresh inputs, ideas.
The IRC country director says one of the biggest problems facing South Sudan is food insecurity.
We do have 3.7 million people at immediate risk of extreme hunger. And of course, the reports have mentioned that if planting season is missed completely and displacement continues over the coming months, we could see 7 million people at risk by the end of the year or early next year, as crops may fail and people would have nothing to eat. And of course, over time, that can develop into extreme starvation.
She says now is the time to pre-position emergency food stocks and distribute farming tools, seeds, and fishing nets.
A lot of people are displaced along the Nile River, which is teeming with fish. So there's a lot that could still be done in the next month or two before the heavy, heavy rains come.
Toiber recently described South Sudan as a place where no one feels safe.
What's been especially upsetting about the fighting of the last few weeks is that places people would normally seek refuge in any time of conflict anywhere in the world, you might think of running to a hospital or a church or a mosque. And in this particular conflict, a lot of people have sought refuge inside the UN bases. All of these have been attacked in the last 2 weeks, you could say.
The International Rescue Committee has not been immune to the violence. Two IRC health workers were shot dead during the recent attack on the UN compound in Bor. Besides health care, the IRC is also providing fresh drinking water and sanitation, as well as prevention and response programs for gender-based violence.
Women and girls are at particular risk in any conflict, as they may be running their own households if their husbands and brothers have gone off to join the fighting.
The International Rescue Committee says the May 20th Donors Conference on South Sudan in Oslo could be critical to avoiding a catastrophe. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Government officials and NGOs testified today about the Central African Republic in the U.S. House of Representatives. The hearing was part of a discussion sponsored by the Subcommittee on Africa, Global Health, Global Human Rights, and International Organizations. The topic of discussion centered on the relief and assistance to the CAR. In early April, the UN Security Council passed a resolution calling for 12,000 peacekeepers to protect civilians. The UN force is expected to take over in September. One of the witnesses called to testify before lawmakers, Robert P. Jackson, said troops from the EU have already begun arriving. Jackson is the Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary of State Department Bureau of African Affairs.
European Union troops are beginning to arrive, and they've started to train 480 police and gendarmes from Central African Republic. We're also today having Assistant Secretary Thomas Greenfield, who's with Secretary Kerry in Addis Ababa, meet with the African Union to discuss the deployment of additional African troops from Burundi and Rwanda, and we hope that that will take place very soon, and we are positioned to move those troops quickly. These troops would replace the Chadians who withdrew at the end of March. We will be going from 7,000 to about 8,200 with the arrival of these additional troops, assuming that the African Union approves both the Rwandan and Burundi contributions. But the EU presence will go from about 100 at present to 500 present, so that will bring us up to close to 9,000.
Mr. Jackson also explained U.S. efforts to end the violence. He said it includes the U.S. is working with the religious community to promote reconciliation in the country.
On April 8th, the U.S. Special Envoy to the Organization of the Islamic Conference, Rashid Hussein, and the Department of State's Senior Advisor on CAR, David Brown, who's here today, led an interfaith delegation of religious leaders from the United States to demonstrate solidarity among religious communities and promote reconciliation. In a show of support for this reconciliation, interfaith participants from the CAR, as well as representatives from the government, civil society, and armed groups, signed a communique renouncing violence and encouraging inter-community and inter-religious dialogue to mitigate tensions and lay the foundation for renewed peaceful coexistence. On April 9th, Ambassador to the United Nations Samantha Power and Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs Linda Thomas Greenfield made their second visit to the CAR in a span of 4 months. During their visit, Ambassador Power, Assistant Secretary Thomas Greenfield met with Transitional President Catherine Samba Panza, commanders of the 7,000-strong African Union and French peacekeeping forces, and members of civil society to express our continued and unwavering determination to end the violence and support the reestablishment of legitimate government. We pledge to work with the government and the international community to help her administration. In response to her requests, we will specifically work to reestablish local law enforcement, transitional justice, and accountability capabilities to end impunity, which has contributed to continued violence against civilians. We are pleased that several countries in the region, the World Bank, the European Union, and other development partners have come forward to help finance basic government services and support alternative work programs that will help put CAR citizens back to work.
Jackson also said the U.S. is working with the U.S. Security Council to implement targeted sanctions against what it called political spoilers and those who are perpetrating the violence. The Department of State has also appointed Ambassador Stuart Samington as the U.S. government special representative to the Central African Republic. Jackson said Mr. Samington will play a leading role in shaping and coordinating U.S. strategy to end the violence, address humanitarian needs, establish legitimate governance, and help the CAR through an inclusive transition process that will lead to democratic elections.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehi Yisuhi, 22 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. South Sudan's warring factions resume face-to-face peace talks today, the third effort this year. And the Committee to Protect Journalists has launched a campaign to highlight the cases of journalists imprisoned around the world. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at African News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
May 3rd marks World Press Freedom Day. On the eve of that occasion, the Committee to Protect Journalists, CPJ, has launched a campaign to highlight the cases of journalists imprisoned by what they have documented some of the world's worst violators of press freedom. The organization says governments have exploited anti-terrorism and national security laws fueled by the September 11th terrorist attacks on the United States. CPJ's Africa Program Coordinator Sue Valentine stresses the importance of this campaign in light of the recent arrest of journalists and bloggers in Ethiopia.
There are so many journalists in jail around the world. CPJ puts out an impunity index every year, but we thought let's try and reduce it to certain key individuals, focus on those human beings who are in jail purely because of their work as journalists, and let's try and focus on those individuals.
Among some of the countries that you have listed as being the worst violators of press freedom are some countries in Africa, such as Eritrea and Ethiopia. For example, can you tell us about the 9 journalists who have been detained in Ethiopia and what is their condition at this time?
This happened last weekend, April 25th, 26th. Police arrested 6 bloggers and 3 journalists. We don't know why. We do know that they are part of a group called Zone 9, which is an organization that was silent for the last 7 or 8 months because of earlier harassment from the Ethiopian authorities. And they're called Zone 9, in fact, because the name is taken from the prison in Ethiopia where many journalists and intellectuals are held, which is divided into 8 zones. And this group has called themselves Zone 9 because it's the zone of free expression that is beyond those prison walls. And these people have been arrested supposedly because they are criminals and are inciting threats to the state. But we believe that this is in fact not the case. They have always iterated their values of peace, wanting to engage with the authorities, asserting their right to freedom of expression. And yet they have been picked up and are facing court appearances next week.
Have you all spoken with any of the government representatives about these arrests?
We have tried to reach them, and we have struggled to get any official response. I know that also, in fact, the prisoners themselves have been denied any visitors from family. So really, it's very hard to penetrate exactly what the authorities, how they would defend these actions.
Some of the journalists that are detained, their health deteriorates. Do you know of the health condition of the journalist in Ethiopia?
Indeed. In addition to these 9 journalists and bloggers who were arrested last weekend, there are 8 other journalists in jail in Ethiopia. Chief among our concerns are for 2 of those 8. One is a woman, Riot Alemu, who was arrested and initially sentenced to 14 years. And on appeal, that was in June 2011. On appeal, the sentence was reduced to 5 years. And Riot Alemu, she's a young woman in her early 30s, but she has developed breast tumors. She's had some treatment, but it's been entirely insufficient, and she is not receiving the kind of treatment that she requires. She has, I think, been treated poorly, not just because the conditions are really bad, but because she has been extremely courageous and outspoken and defiant, and not conceding that her work in writing about the situation in Ethiopia equals terrorism, which is the charge and the conviction that was brought against her. Similarly, another journalist, Wubshet Tai, he has had kidney troubles and he needs urgent treatment and has also not been receiving it. He was moved to a prison closest to Addis Ababa and then moved to a prison somewhat further away, making it very difficult for his wife to visit him.
Concerning the journalist in Eritrea, can you tell us about their condition?
One of the 10 journalists to flee from prisons who is part of our campaign is a man by the name of David Isaac. He was the co-founder of a newspaper called Sitit and was arrested in September 2001. I think in the wake of the 9/11 attacks in the U.S., the Eritrean authorities took that moment to sweep down across the privately owned press in Eritrea and arrested a number of journalists. 16 others were jailed.
Do you think the international community is doing enough to try to help to release these journalists?
These are working journalists asserting their rights to work as professionals, to do their job of reflecting issues in society to fellow citizens, to their leaders. We would love to see the international community doing much more, but we are very concerned that there's so much emphasis on economic growth without equal emphasis on the importance of transparency, accountability, and the important role of the central role of a free press in holding governments to account and ensuring that development betters all the citizens of a country.
That was Sue Valentine, the Africa Program Coordinator for the CPJ. She spoke with me from Cape Town, South Africa.
With Kim Lewis, I'm Yehi Yisroohib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
In Africa offers splendid sounds from the continent that all humanity calls home. From the classics of yesteryear to the hot tracks of the moment. I offer you what you need. Free ear therapy and mind massage. Join me, I'm Heather Maxwell, for Music Time in Africa, every Saturday and Sunday at 0900, 2000 and 2100 UTC.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top story this hour. South Sudan's warring factions resumed face-to-face peace talks today, the third such effort this year. And coming up, music from Algeria. And in our feature segment, a World Bank report says educators fail to teach the right skills to school children in Africa. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehias Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. And of course, it's time now for the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young. Hello, Sunny.
Hello, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you'll be kicking off with World Cup football news today.
Yes, I am, Kim. But first, let me say happy Thursday and happy May to all our Voice of America listeners. With the World Cup football tournament kicking off June 12th in Brazil, the head coaches of the 32 participating teams continue to monitor players as they get ready to name their final rosters. Now, one young African player hoping to make his World Cup debut is 21-year-old Ghanaian defender Masahoudou Alhassan, who is based in Italy with the club Latina on loan from Udinese. In a telephone interview from Italy with my VOA colleague Peter Cloti, Alhassan said he was recently contacted by Ghana's World Cup coach, Kwesi Appia.
Yeah, he came here about 3 weeks ago, and he called me to greet me and see you. What am I doing? What is our league going on? So I tell him everything. But, you know, I worked with him like two or three years ago, under 23. And I worked with him Blaster last 2 years ago. He was the assistant coach. So he know me very much. So me, I'm not surprised that maybe he will call me because he know me, I can do it. So if he called me, maybe it's not a surprise.
When he called you, what did he want to find out? What did he tell you?
He asked me about my playing time, if I get more playing time, and I told him yes right now. It's not like last season, I played 18 matches, and that was not enough. But this season, at least I played like 33 matches, and to me, it's very, very good. So I tell him, and he said to me that I should continue.
Was he positive about monitoring you as part of his gathering his team for the World Cup?
Okay, the way he talked, it means like he's happy. He's happy. The way he sounds, he's happy. Like, you know, we talk on phone, so I don't know whether he's happy or not. The way he sounds, like he's happy.
So how is playing in Italy been for you? Do you think that will enhance your chances of being invited by Coach Kwesi Appia to play at the World Cup?
You know, in European football, the country who used to defend a lot is Italian. And me, I'm a defender, and I'm playing in Italy. So I learned a lot about how to defend. So I went to Udine, and they told me that last season I played 18 matches. So that is not enough. So this season I'm supposed to play more matches. So they're supposed to loan me to get more playing time before I can go there. So right now, I learned a lot. I learned a lot how to defend. So right now, everything is going on good.
What will it be like for you to be invited to play in Brazil for Ghana at the World Cup?
Yeah, I'll be very, very happy in my life because, you know, World Cup in Brazil, everybody wants to play, every player wants to go there. You know, it's not easy to play in World Cup and a very, very young player like me. So I'll be very, very happy if I go to Brazil.
Knowing some of these players and knowing the coach very well, you have worked with him for some time now. What do you see as some of the strengths that he brings to the team?
Okay, right now he is a coach and we know the materials we need to go with the World Cup. So if he called me, I'll be very, very happy. I will help him to build his team. I will help him to do the job because I can't do it alone. He will do it with other players and he's the coach. So he knows the materials he will send to the World Cup. And if I go, I'll listen to the instruction and I'll make sure I'll follow the instruction he will give it to me.
What message do you want to give Ghanaians who sometimes have been watching your matches in Italy?
Okay, I'll give them this message to them because 2012, they invited me and I was in Genova in junior side and I put them. And this time I'm playing the first division here. If they call me, I'll be happy and I'll do more than the way I've done first time. I'll do more, and they will be happy for me.
When you work with Coach Kwesi Appiah, how did he treat you? Did he have confidence in you? Did he work with you? Did he show you what he did? Knowing his pedigree as a captain at one time of the senior national team, and now he's the coach, how was the relationship between you and him?
Okay, first of all, he made me Masoda last night because he made me, nobody know me. He called me for under 23. We played some quarter match with Nigeria in Kumasi. So he gave me a lot of confidence. He said, Mas, you can play, so go and do it. So I went inside and we won 2-0 and we qualified. And he know me, he know I can do it. But he told me that, Mas, you need more playing time before I can call you. So my problem is like, last year I played like 18 matches, and to him, it's like a small. So this time I played 33 matches, and 33 matches is enough. And he left 6 more matches to go. So he know I can do it, but he said my problem is, Mas, you know, you're supposed to get more playing time. That's my problem. And right now, I'm playing every day, every Sunday.
That's Ghanaian footballer Masahudu Alhassan, who, as we just heard him say, is playing regularly in the Italian league. And Alhassan was speaking by telephone from Italy with my VOA colleague, Peter Cloti. And it'll be very interesting to see who Coach Kwesi Appiah selects for Ghana's World Cup team. Ghana was the top-performing African squad at the 2010 FIFA World Cup in South Africa, where it reached the quarterfinals. And a reminder for our VOA football fans, the 4 other African teams going to Brazil next month also qualified for South Africa 2010. They are Algeria, Cameroon, Ivory Coast, and African champion Nigeria. And a second reminder as we look forward to the World Cup, Kwesi Appiah and the other World Cup coaches need to submit preliminary 30-man World Cup rosters to FIFA, World Football's governing body, by May 13th. And their final 23-man World Cup rosters must be sent to FIFA by June 2nd. Elsewhere in African football, Ethiopia and Tanzania recently hired new head coaches. For more details, we turn once again to our African football guru, David Legg.
The Taifa Stars of Tanzania have not been doing well for some time. They've had a couple of Danish coaches. The most recent one was Kim Poulsen, but sadly, because of poor results, he's got the axe. And they've brought in a man who's no stranger to Africa. It's Mart Nooy. He's a Dutchman. He's a former coach of the Burkina Faso youth side, and more recently the Mozambique senior side. And with Mozambique, he had mixed results, some good, some not so good. Anyway, his job is to try and elevate Tanzania, and it's going to be a very tough start because in the Cup of Nations draw, they would face Zimbabwe, and ironically, if they can get past Zimbabwe, they would face Mozambique. Another East African country, Ethiopia, they've named Mariano Barreto from Portugal as the successor to Sunet Bishol. Now, Sunet Bishol is the man who basically lifted Ethiopia from the doldrums, but he paid the price for very poor results at the 2014 CHAN, where Ethiopia failed to score and lost all their matches. So interesting developments then in East Africa. And looking at Tanzania's results at the weekend, a 3-0 friendly defeat at home to Burundi, you must say Nooy has clearly got his work cut out if he's going to get those Taifa Stars into the Africa Cup of Nations group phase. VOA!
David, if our VOA listeners have a football-related question for you, can you give us your email address?
Yes, certainly, Sonny. It's david.legg, and legg is spelled L-E-G-G-E, at AFP, that's Agence France Presse, .com. So I'll just repeat that one more time. It's david.legg, L-E-G-G-E, at AFP.com. And we'd love to hear from you.
Hi, I'm Shegu Adeyemi, coming to you all the way from Lagos, Nigeria. Weekends are for sports. Nightline Africa Sports, that is. And every Sunday, I'll give you highlights of the top sports stories of the past week and the weekend. Nightline Africa Sports from the Voice of America. Let the games begin. We got the game.
In National Basketball Association playoff action Wednesday night, there was one game in Canada and two in Texas, and the home team won all three contests. The results: in Canada, the host Toronto Raptors edged the Brooklyn Nets 115-113. Toronto now leads this first round best of seven game series 3-2. In a Texas showdown, the San Antonio Spurs beat the Dallas Mavericks 109-103. San Antonio now leads 3-2. And in another game played in Texas, the Houston Rockets avoided elimination with a 108-98 victory over the Portland Trail Blazers. Portland still leads this series 3-2. In other NBA news, Los Angeles Lakers coach Mike D'Antoni has resigned after less than two seasons on the job. D'Antoni and the injury-plagued Lakers had a record of 27 wins and 55 losses this past season. It was their worst campaign in more than 50 years. Lakers stars Kobe Bryant, Steve Nash, and Pau Gasol all sat out large chunks of the season with injuries. Overall, the Lakers had a record of 67 wins and 87 losses under D'Antoni. Former Lakers star Magic Johnson was thrilled with D'Antoni's resignation. Magic tweeted, "Happy days are here again. I couldn't be happier." Magic was also one of the former star players who was happy with the lifetime ban given Los Angeles Clippers owner Donald Sterling for making racist remarks. Sterling was also fined $2.5 million by NBA Commissioner Adam Silver, who says he will do everything possible to have Sterling sell the team. Among those mentioned as possible buyers of the Clippers are, yes, Magic Johnson, as well as Oprah Winfrey, the popular U.S. television talk show host. I'm VOA Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Yahias Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Very interesting, Sonny. Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 1730 hours UTC right here on the Voice of America.
In our feature segment, a World Bank report says educators fail to teach the right skills to school children in Africa. And next, things are looking up for East Africa's largest economy, Kenya. But first, some music. Here is Idir and Nadia with Amon Per.
Citoyenne, que je me lève, c'est pour toi que je t'ai. Mes sentiments d'amour pour ma foi et mon enfant.
Face à ton destin, n'oublie jamais que le respect sera toujours comme la racine de notre famille.
Mon patrimoine, c'est par toi, citoyenne, que je m'élève, c'est pour toi que je t'ai. Mes sentiments par amour, pour ma foi et mon enfant.
Tu sais, ben, il y a des choses entre une fille et son père qui ne se disent pas chez nous. Mais une chose est sûre, c'est que tu m'as toujours dit de respecter les autres et de travailler dur, dur pour aller toujours plus loin, toujours plus haut. Et tu m'as rendue citoyenne du monde.
Parce que Ziram se veut d'être l'homme libre, tu porteras ce nom comme on porte le destin. C'est un peu de moi, même si je ne te le dis pas. Je suis entre tes mains comme l'eau sacrée d'un pays. Citoyenne de ce monde, ta vie sera ma vie.
Que je m'élève, c'est pour toi que je t'ai. Mes sentiments par amour, pour ma foi et mon enfant.
À mon père, j'ai à dire tellement de choses. À mon père, cet homme libre, roi de sa terre, qui sans lire et sans écrire a su faire de sa vie pour devenir.
C'est par toi que survit mon patrimoine. C'est par toi, citoyenne, que je m'élève, c'est pour toi que je t'ai. Mes sentiments par amour, pour ma foi et mon enfant.
À mon père, j'ai à dire tellement de choses. À mon père, cet homme libre, roi de sa terre. À mon père.
From Algeria, Idira Nadia with A Mon Père.
Well, Yehaya's World Bank experts report that school children in most of Africa cannot read a sentence by the second or third grade. African educators say schools fail to teach the right skills, math, science, engineering, and technology, to the 11,000 youth who will enter Africa's growing job market every year. VOA's Miriamo Diallo spoke with educators and a co-author of the bank's report.
The World Bank says that more than 70% of African children complete primary school, up from about 50% in 1990. But the quality of that education is in question. A recent World Bank report notes that lack of a solid foundation in reading and mathematics makes it harder for young workers to get more productive jobs. Dion Filmer is co-author of the report.
For a group of southern and eastern African countries, this regionally benchmarked exercise identified that 60% of sixth graders, after 6 years of schooling, could not reach the level what they define as beginning numeracy. That means that these kids can recognize numbers, but they really don't know what to do with them.
The report also shows that in a number of countries, including Uganda and Mali, more than 70% of students in grade 2 and 3 could not read a single word of a simple paragraph.
What we see is tremendous progress at getting children in school, even getting children to complete primary school. But what we don't see is a lot of learning taking place in the classroom.
Serigne Baykam, the Senegalese education minister, recently attended the World Bank IMF spring meetings in Washington. He points out that another important problem is the mismatch between the education system and the labor market.
On nous demande de former des gens pour des métiers qui n'existent pas encore.
We are asked to educate people for future jobs that don't exist yet, to teach them how to solve problems that haven't occurred, and using teaching methods that have not been developed yet. That's why I believe in the education sector we should create departments that would look into what tomorrow's professions will be like, so we can train people to be ready for that.
Cham also says schools need to emphasize more science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, the so-called STEM fields.
L'évaluation
de notre système éducatif nous amène à constater que
when we evaluated our education system, we realized that only 20% of our high school graduates were in the STEM fields. We've developed a system which we hope that by 2025, 60% of the graduates will be in the literary and scientific fields.
Development experts say improving education will help Africa's youth be more competitive at home and in the global market. But for educated workers to get jobs, Africa's leaders must create a better business environment with access to land, capital, infrastructure, and technology. In Washington, Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
Terrorist attacks in Nairobi and other towns in Kenya have dealt the country's economy a big blow in the last few years. But officials say the country is on a path to recovery. Henry Rotich is Kenya's cabinet secretary for National Treasury. He tells VOA's Vincent McCauley things are looking up for East Africa's largest economy.
Our calculations indicate that we are likely to grow by about 5%. The 5.8 is the forecast for this year. Mm-hmm.
Now, for any finance secretary, I think it's always critical to save money. For years, Kenyans bemoan the loss of billions through misappropriation, corruption, bad tendering, where we give the highest bidder rather than the lowest bidder. What are you doing right now to make sure that you can eliminate those loopholes?
That we have a new law, public financial management law. Before, we've not had a law. The law spells out clearly how public money it will be used. So we are implementing this law. We have just issued regulations to ensure that all spending agencies follow the regulations as opposed to following previous, you know, circulars that were not adhered to. So at least now we have get a clear legal framework on that. We are also doing a lot to improve the procurement of goods. We're going to introduce a new procurement law to ensure that there is efficiency in the utilization of resources, and that should help reduce a lot of, you know, spending. But we believe going forward with the clear legal framework, we should deal with this challenge once and for all.
The Kenyan diaspora is very keen on investing back home, but there's always complaints about challenges back there. They feel like things haven't been streamlined. We want a registration of businesses, perhaps transactions when it comes especially to land and registration and all. What are you doing to ensure that you make it easier for someone here to bring money back home?
It's true that there have been some, you know, constraints in those areas that you have mentioned. And we actually, over the last 2 years, we've slipped back based on World Bank indicators that they have just released, which attest to clearly what you have said. We've now worked on a very comprehensive plan to implement very specific reforms in the areas that have been identified that has been a challenge in doing business, particularly in the land registry. We are also introducing a new law, company law and insolvency law, which will revolutionize how the registration of business will be. This law is already before Parliament. As you know, the Companies Act that we are operating in is very archaic, from 1948. So we need to update our laws first governing business.
But Kenya has had a beating since 2008 because of insecurity. Al-Shabaab and other terrorist groups are not making it any easier. So how can you possibly attract investors?
You already have noticed the actions the government has done of late in terms of dealing with the refugee challenges and immigration issues. We have also given police the necessary capacities in terms of the mobility. We are working on their welfare, including also the housing and all that. I think the actions that we are putting to modernize our security operators are going to deal with these problems once and for all. And we do expect, together with the actions we are doing on improving the business climate, should make Kenya a very attractive area to invest.
That's Henry Rotich, who is Kenya's cabinet secretary for National Treasury. He was speaking with VOA's Vincent Makori. This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our African News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Wojtek Zorniak, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On April 28th, in the United States, in Israel, and in many places around the world, we observe Yom HaShoah, which means Day of Remembrance of the Holocaust. In ceremonies across the globe, observers read from the Book of Names and light six candles in honor of the 6 million Jews who perished. Holocaust survivors engage with their communities and share their personal stories. The Holocaust was the greatest crime in human history. 6 million Jews were murdered by the Nazi regime and its collaborators solely because they were Jewish. It began in the 1930s when the Nazi Party came to power and the German government began to target those they deemed to be inherently inferior. Such people, mostly civilians, were rounded up, shut into ghettos, and deported to dozens of concentration or slave labor camps. Some were shot and dumped into mass graves. By 1941, a number of camps were being run specifically for mass killing. Those sent to slave labor camps were slowly starved or worked to death. In addition to Jews, the Nazis targeted a number of other groups, including Roma, the disabled, homosexuals, and the Slavic peoples, because of their perceived inferiority. Some were persecuted on political or ideological grounds, among them communists, socialists, Jehovah's Witnesses, Freemasons, and anyone who resisted the Nazi dictatorship. In the aftermath of the Second World War, the international community resolved never again to allow such atrocities to occur. In 1948, the United Nations General Assembly adopted the Convention on the Prevention and the Punishment of the Crime of Genocide. In 1979, the United States Congress established the Day of Remembrance and later the Holocaust Memorial Museum to keep the memory of the victims alive for future generations. Today, this museum has its own center for genocide prevention. The legacy of Holocaust victims enriches our understanding and is a symbol of the meaning of human dignity. In America, survivors remind us of the importance of tolerance by speaking in classrooms and community institutions across the country. They serve as living history, sharing their stories and recounting the experiences of all who perished. Poet Claire Guest writes, "We couldn't stop the horror. We couldn't stop the hate. We can't change history. We are here too late. But what we can do is remember in our thoughts and in our ways. Let these memories guide our actions."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Hello, I'm Douglas Simpoga. Join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas on the topic at hand. So, please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.